Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Around the world, the trip begins with a kiss. Roam if you want to, roam around the world. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard another edition of Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Hope you're having a wonderful mid-December, wherever you happen to be. Can you believe it? Only about a week before Christmas. That's wild. Okay, I can say it now. Summer's over. I don't want to say it, but... okay, I've been forced to do it. Hope you have a wonderful time, as I said. And we are actually taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. And in case you're wondering where we are, last week, of course, we were at the Jefferson Hotel in Washington, D.C., the legendary Jefferson Hotel. We're coming to you from 39 degrees, 55 minutes north, 116 degrees, 23 minutes east. Does the words meow ring a bell? We're coming to you from Beijing in China, from the opposite house, in a wild cutting-edge architectural hotel right here in Beijing. The opposite house is, for someone like me who's been coming to Beijing for, let's just say since 1972, quite a surprise. When I first came here, the only decent hotel was called the Great Wall. How about that? It was a Sheraton. And of course, it was distinguished by this, rooftop circular revolving restaurant that pretty soon every hotel in China tried to emulate. And of course, everywhere you went, they had the rooftop circulating restaurant. When I was driving to the hotel yesterday, I passed by the old Great Wall Hotel, and it is old. In fact, it looks like it was abandoned right before they made the movie Armageddon, and renamed, of course, no longer a Sheraton. But this hotel, about 2 years old, just cutting edge. Lots of the design of this hotel is worth just a visit, whether you stay here or not. Lots of stuff to talk about in the news before we get to your phone calls and, of course, our guests. Here's a surprise for you, or maybe not. Airfares, year over year, up about 19 and sometimes as much as 21% over last year. So is it a surprise to you that as airfares go up and the economy is still not going great, guess who's driving? Well, we are. That's right. Bus travel on the rise, whether it's Greyhound or Megabus or Peter Pan. In many cases, we're talking not just a little bit of an increase in ridership. How about 70% increase in riders throughout the Midwest and Northeast system of these bus lines? Pretty amazing. And, it's not surprising when you consider the fact that the airfares compared to the bus fares, ridiculously low on the bus fare side. Megabus is still advertising certain fares that start at $1 on the internet. Of course, not every seat on every bus. But the point is, those fares are attracting a whole lot of other people, especially on short-haul flights or short-haul routes. And what's interesting about that is, yes, the fares are down. Yes, the ridership is up. However, and we'll be doing this as a piece on the CBS News very soon, what about bus safety standards? I just thought I'd throw that out there. What about training standards for the drivers? What about rules for how many hours they need to sleep before they get on the bus to drive it? A lot of stuff just isn't there or isn't being enforced. And so I'm just throwing that out there. I'm not pointing fingers at any one bus company. But how about this? Seatbelts. How many buses are actually equipped with seatbelts? They make you wear them on the plane. Why not on the bus? Especially when you consider that a lot of buses, the construction standards of those buses are not too thrilling. When you consider that they're not properly rollover proof, meaning crumple proof roofs on buses. Where are the roll bars? Where are the supports? And where are the federal safety standards? Where are the state safety standards for intrastate buses as opposed to just the ones that cross state borders? So, we'll be working on that story, but the good news is if you're just price sensitive, bus travel the way to go. Bus travel also the way to go for a number of former American Airlines executives who no longer have their jobs. I think they took the bus as well. I said it before, and I've said it over the last couple of weeks. I'll say it again now. Here's an airline, the last remaining legacy carrier that did not file for bankruptcy, that did not merge. Well, they've done one of those two things now. They filed for bankruptcy, and I'll make you another prediction. They will merge, or they will be absorbed. Hard to believe it, because the words American Airlines are, I mean, that you can't get more iconic a brand as a flag carrier. You're going to see the airline shrink. There is no doubt about it. They'll probably try to expand in Asia. They just did a code-sharing deal with Hainan Airlines, an airline you've never heard about. But here we are in Beijing, where this airline is based. They fly to over 60 cities that you've never even heard of. What a great hub they have here in Beijing, and they fly all new equipment. And they just did a code-share agreement with American, which means they actually fly, for those people who live in the Pacific Northwest, nonstop from Seattle to Beijing, and nobody knows it. But now you know it. And now, if you're that addicted to the mileage program, you actually get American miles on Hainan Airlines. But bottom line is, American itself, other than trying to expand in Asia through partnerships and code sharing, has to shrink. You're going to see them. I would bet my career on the idea that they're going to start shrinking in the Caribbean because they don't get enough yield there. And even though they're going to be getting some new airplanes, bottom line is that, listen to this, on 40 of its top routes, American's business fares dropped 4% this year, whereas Continental's rose 7% and Delta's rose 13%. What does that tell you about where American was making or losing money? They were discounting to try to get the one passenger they desperately needed, business travelers. So bottom line here, you're going to see a smaller airline. You're going to see an airline cutting back on routes that they already have, reallocating their planes to what they perceive to be more profitable routes. And then, isn't it interesting that the one airline that might come after them is the one airline over the last 2 years that tried to come after everybody? U.S. Air. Remember, they tried to merge with Delta? They tried to merge with everybody. Well, they only have about 8% of market share in the United States. However, they're in a healthier position for the moment than American Airlines is. I mean, imagine American Airlines only having a market cap of about $600 million. That's nothing considering the size of that airline. U.S. Air, with only 8% of the market share, could be in a perfect position to take over American to save itself as well. Being a standalone these days is not a healthy position to be in. And my prediction, whether you like it or not, and by the way, I don't think there's any reason to like it, is that within 3 years, we won't be flying airlines. We'll be flying alliances. We'll be flying Oneworld. We'll be flying Sky. We'll be flying Star. Branding won't be important if you only have a couple of airlines left. It'll be an oligopoly that will control gates, that will control slots, and sorry, folks, they will control fares. And we may actually go back to the days prior to that series called Pan Am, where the only people who could fly were the people who had to fly or the privileged elite. So something to think about there. When we come back, we'll talk about that and a lot of other things with our good friend Arnie Weissman, the editor-in-chief of Travel Weekly. We'll be back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the opposite house in Beijing, China, right after these messages.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from the opposite house in Beijing. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER, and if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air, and as I do every week at this time on the show, I encourage you to go to our website with the imaginative name of petergreenberg.com for one very important reason. You'll find our comprehensive list there of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that hard and essential work in Japan, in Western China, in Chile, in Haiti, of course, and in Christchurch. All of those locations, victims of either earthquakes and or tsunamis in the last 10 years, actually in the last 2 years. The reason why I mentioned 10 years is because that's how long the rebuilding effort's going to have to take in Haiti. They need your help. And if you look at that list, you'll be pleasantly surprised to see all the different ways you can actively and in person participate up close and on location in that rebuilding effort based on what you bring to the party. And everybody does bring something different to the party, whether you're a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, there's something you can do. It's the best vacation you could ever give yourself because you're giving back to others in the process. So check out that list. You will not be disappointed. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Nancy on the phone from somewhere in New York. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Pete. How are you?
I'm okay. How can I help you today?
Well, I'm wondering if you're ever going to do a segment on New York Christmas. And I've been reading a lot about going to Europe for Christmas. How is it in Christmas in Europe? I'd love to go.
Well, I'd much rather leave the United States for Christmas anyway, because you have two things that go on at Christmas overseas. First of all, of course, they all celebrate it, but the best part about it is other Christmas markets, especially in Eastern Europe, in Germany, in parts of southern France, great Christmas markets that you go to like right now. Bottom line is the airfares. This is the irony of it all. The actual airfare from New York City to Washington, D.C. on the U.S. Air Shuttle right now, round trip for a flight that only lasts 38 minutes, is $607. You could actually go from Chicago to Istanbul for Christmas for $580. So it's a no-brainer. You should go.
All right. Well, okay. I'll certainly go.
Okay. Well, then it'll be a Christmas for both of you at that point. Nancy, good luck with that and have a very happy holiday.
We
appreciate
that.
You got it. And joining us now, our good friend, the regular on our show, the editor-in-chief and vice president of Travel Weekly, our good pal, Arnie Weissman. Hey, Arnie.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Good. And we're coming to you by satellite, by the way, from Beijing, so you may hear about a second and a half delay, but we'll work with that. Arnie, earlier in the show, I was talking about the bankruptcy filing recently for American Airlines, how it looks like they're going to have to shrink the airline in order to maintain, have to cut back on lots of different things, may have to even redefine what the airline is. One of the things that's already happened before American even filed for bankruptcy is that 2011 was a year in which a lot of jobs were lost in the travel industry.
Yes, it really was a surprise in some ways, because travel sits in sort of a strange place in the recession. I've been spending the last week speaking with various CEOs for our preview issue. We talk to people in every vertical, in hotels and airlines, tour operators, cruise lines, and just sort of say, what are your predictions for 2012? So far, every single person who I've spoken to has said, you know, 2011 wasn't that bad, and 2012 looks better. And when we get into a conversation about it, All the companies are, of course, looking forward to the day when the economic uncertainty begins to lift, because they all feel they are leaner and meaner than they have ever been before. The one thing the recession has done is it has, across the board in the travel industry, companies let people go and found ways to continue on without them. And I think that trend just keeps continuing as long as we're in this economic uncertainty.
And that's despite the fact that at the same time they also increased prices. I'm looking at airfare averages this year over year, up about 19%. I know you may have some other figures on that, but we were looking at 19% figures just at this time of the year over last year.
Yes. And the airlines in particular have been very, very disciplined about making sure their fares stay higher. Whenever a route is not performing as they want to do it, they have no problem in reducing frequency to that city, so that it's a supply and demand question. And they want to keep the supply very, very tight, which, you know, keep it in line with demand. So if demand goes down, they will cut capacity.
Interestingly enough, we just did a piece that I did on CBS about three airlines that are literally flying below the radar that most of my listeners and maybe most of your readers have never heard of. And yet they're doing quite well because they figured out how to pick and choose routes that nobody's flying. And they're not flying them twice a day. They're not even flying them once a day. They're flying it twice a week. Airlines like Allegiant or Vision. And then the little secret business travel airline that goes up to Canada, Porter. I mean, when you think about it, Arnie, you know, you think, well, I understand L.A., New York, the Transcon, but who flies between Myrtle Beach and Grand Rapids, Michigan, nonstop? Well, Allegiant does. Or who flies between Allentown, PA, and Orlando? Well, they do. But they're only flying it maybe twice a week, and they're filling their planes.
Yes. There's actually some international carriers have done very well by also looking at secondary cities and flying to them, and the demand has been surprising. One of those Austrian airlines, which was acquired by Lufthansa, has really made that the centerpiece of their plans, of their strategic plans. And they'll go from some city in Romania, you know, they'll provide service from Vienna to all these secondary cities, and it has been hugely profitable for them.
Exactly. And then I mentioned Porter Airlines. They're based in Toronto, but what's cool about Porter is they fly to the coolest little airport I've ever landed. I talk about a boutique. It's not Pearson, which may take you up to an hour and a half to 2 hours to get into town once you land. It's the Toronto Island Airport. Literally, you land on this little island, you get off the plane, you walk 20 feet to a ferry boat, the world's shortest ferry ride, I think it's 3 minutes, takes you to a dock, and you're in downtown Toronto. And for business travelers, it's a godsend, and they fly Newark-Toronto, they fly Chicago-Toronto, they fly Boston-Toronto, and of course, within Canada, they fly to about 16 other cities. Very cool operation, because they figured out where people really wanted to go as opposed to having to go through somebody else's hub.
Yeah, there's actually, British Airways has a service, I don't know if you've taken it, to a little-known airport called London City Airport, and it's out in an area called
the Docklands. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, this flight is wonderful. Not only is it it's a small plane, you go into a small airport, but I arrived 2 hours earlier, as you're supposed to for international flights. They almost didn't know what to do with me. You know, they said, it'll take you 5 minutes to go through security, and then, 2 minutes to get to the gate. You know, you are here earlier than anyone else on this flight. Everyone else apparently knew. So these little airports in the big cities are just a terrific thing if you know about them and in some cases can afford them because they tend to be more expensive.
And let me tell you about that flight that you mentioned. It's BA Flight 1, by the way. And on the way back, it's called BA Flight 2 from JFK to London City Airport. But on the way back, they're using Airbus 320s. They don't have the range to come back against the headwinds. So the bad news is you have to stop in Ireland on the way home. Here's the good news. You pre-clear U.S. Customs there so that when you get back to Kennedy, there's no madness. You're not in a refugee center. You just get off the plane, get your bags, and go home. Or if you're interconnecting your bags, they just interconnect. You don't have to go schlep your bags and go through customs and put them back on a belt. That, to me, has great value.
Yes, and in fact, you arrive as a domestic passenger. You get off the plane, and you're in the midst of the domestic passenger terminal, and off you go.
That would be my wish list for 2012, and I think you'll jump on that list, Arnie, when I say we should actually target U.S. Customs pre-clearance at Heathrow, at Gatwick, at Charles de Gaulle, at Rome. I mean, for the big international connecting cities, it would save everybody money. It would save airlines on fuel burn. It would save airlines on misconnected bags, on misconnected passengers. You have enough time to go pre-clear there anyway, since they want you out there so early for the flight to begin with. It's a win-win for everybody.
Yes, yeah. Have you, by the way, Peter, registered for the kiosks when you come in through customs?
You're talking about Global Entry.
Global Entry. Have you used that?
I haven't yet because I haven't had time to go get my interview, but I'm going to go do the interview and get it done. And you know what? It's $100, and it's a done deal, and it saves you a lot of time.
I can't tell you how pleasant it is. I've used it now maybe 7 or 8 times, and you just – I mean, the lines – I come in through JFK mostly. The lines can be enormous. I have never had to wait for a kiosk. You walk right up. They give you a receipt. And then you go straight when you leave the airport, too. You jump to the front of the line.
Amazing. Arnie Weissman, as always, editor-in-chief for Travel Weekly. Arnie, thanks for joining us. Have a wonderful rest of your holiday season. And we'll be back with more from the opposite house in Beijing, China, with the wild look at China right after this.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. Vacation, oh, everyone's in love. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the Opposite House in Beijing, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. Anytime I go to a city, especially one like Beijing, I've got to find the locals because they know where to go, they know how to go, they know when to go. And my next guest embodies all three. She's the founder of a company called Wild China. That name alone means she has to be on this show. Her name is Mei Zhang. Hey, Mei.
Hi, Peter.
When people come to China, especially when we're talking Beijing, because that's where we are right now, when they first come here, you know they've already had their list. You know, they have to go see the Great Wall. They have to go see the Forbidden City. They have to go see Tiananmen Square. They have to do all those things. And they should. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I always want to know, what else can I see that is not in the brochure, that's not in the guidebook? And that's where you come in.
Yes. I very much like to tell people, Wild China is about seeing the familiar places from a different angle. So you get a sense of what's behind. For example, the Great Wall is very interesting, but if you just walk the Great Wall and see the bricks and the mountains, that's the scenery. Who do you interact with? You go to the little villages at the foot of the wall.
But a lot of people don't do that.
No, you have to have access.
Yeah.
You have to have the right locals to take you there. This is one reason I love having a local guide wherever I go. They open the doors. They welcome you into the families of the locals and take you to the villages so you can see the live and breathing wall. You know what I mean?
You're sure. And it's also the time that you go. I remember when I first came here, and everybody thought I was nuts. I said, no, I want the driver to pick me up at 4:30 in the morning. I want to get to the base of the Great Wall by 5:15 when there are no tour buses, no lines, no crowds. And I want to walk up in the pre-dawn darkness so that when I get up to at least a reasonable level, I have to have that experience of watching the sun rise over the wall when I'm on it. And I got up there, and there were like seven older Chinese gentlemen doing their Tai Chi, and that was it. That was the whole experience. But wow, how great was that? Talk about a photo opportunity. And it was only about an hour and a half later when I was walking back down that I looked down. I saw all the tour buses coming up the hill with everybody screaming with their pictures. And it was like, okay, I did the right thing. And by the way, I do the same thing at the Taj Mahal. I do the same things at the pyramids at Giza. It's all about the light as well.
Yes. And also, you can imagine one of our guests, a very well-known actual movie star, coming here. And we said, you know what? We're going to find you a local host. And you are going to have dinner on the Great Wall. And imagine driving in the traffic in Beijing, you probably haven't seen by now.
Nuts.
So you're driving the opposite direction. At 5 p.m., you're driving towards the Great Wall when everybody else is already coming back. And then you get there at one of the grandest sections of the Great Wall, and there it is, white linen covered, a table, glass of wine, and friends' conversation, and the sunset, it's divine.
And that's what qualifies as one of those life-changing moments, if you will. That's a memory. That's
yes.
a memory.
Yes, we shoot for some of these wow moments so you will remember.
When you're dealing with a city as big as Beijing, if you go 20 miles outside of Beijing, you're in a different world.
Absolutely.
Let me explain. When I first came here, right, the big hotel in town was the Sheraton Great Wall, right? It was that stupid little revolving restaurant. But it was the hottest hotel in town. Everybody wanted to stay there because it was like modern and new. Coming into this hotel yesterday, and this hotel is modern and new in the Opposite House, but coming towards the hotel yesterday, I passed what remains of the Great Wall Hotel. It's been renamed. It looks like it was evacuated prior to Armageddon, you know. And yet all around the city, I mean, the national bird of China has to be the building crane. I mean, there's still so much construction going on. Every high rise, every cutting edge branded item that you can imagine. And if you're not careful, even in Beijing, or especially in Beijing, you'd think you could be in Cleveland with all the different comfort areas that you know from your own life, whether it's Starbucks or you know, Subway. Okay, fine. But 20 minutes outside, that's the brave new world.
Yes, it's very different. I mean, for the past couple of years, we actually lived in American Washington, D.C.
Well, that's a brave new world.
Well, no. But my point is, bringing my children from Washington, D.C. to come back, we used to come back every year, now we live here. But every time coming back, staying in one of these hotels, my daughter would think going to Beijing is going to, like, the Xixi world. This is the cooler part of the world. Everything's new, everything's shiny. But once you get out, actually, even if you turn into a certain street in downtown Beijing, there's a different world. There is quite a bit difference, disparity, different lifestyle in the same city block.
And especially from an American perspective, all the things that we take for granted as to the functionality of our life. I mean, here I am at the opposite house. We've got cutting-edge sinks, cutting-edge toilets, lovely bathtubs. We've got hot and cold water. We've got great food. But part of that, I mean, I'm not trying to be cute about it, is part of the beauty of rural China when you actually see the way it is still for a majority of Chinese. I mean, here we are. We're on the radio here. We have internet. We have all, but not out there.
Oh, no, no. When you go to certain parts of China.
Certain parts they do, yes, but.
One of the experiences I was told by our clients that was surprising was that they went to this sort of not very well-known place in Yunnan, and they went to this little village to visit a shaman who practices, you know, he's the religious leader of the village. And the house they went to visit was beautiful, located in the village, sort of in front of the mountain.
I'm going to have you hold on to that thought for 1 second, and we're going to come back to that little village when we return with Mei Zhang and Wild China from the Opposite House Hotel right here in Beijing. Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the Opposite House in Beijing, China. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88 Peter. We've been talking to Mei Zhang, who runs this great tour operation here with an appropriate name, Wild China. We were left off of going to a small little village or a small little province. Continue.
Our guests approach this house in a beautiful valley surrounded by mountains. This was way off in southwest China, in Yunnan province. It's high up in elevation, about 7,000 feet up. The house itself looks absolutely gorgeous. You walk in there, in the courtyard, the first thing you notice is this gigantic satellite dish. And you wonder, what is this for? And you walk into the house, and the house is sparsely decorated, sort of like this, but in a very different style because they don't have any furniture. And you see the wiring running from the satellite to this gigantic other signature piece in the house, which is a huge TV.
I'm shocked.
And there are wet towels hanging on those wires. And for anybody coming from America, you go like, a hazard, this is a fire hazard, but there's nothing else around. And then they have a couple of stools and cooking over open fire. As you are talking to the host, who is very simply dressed in their local costume, and then the next moment his phone would ring and he whips out the cell phone. So he has a satellite TV, a satellite dish and a cell phone. And you look around the house, there's no furniture, there's no plumbing, no fresh running water. And the outhouse is about 100 meters away. And so our guests are shocked. So that this is sort of how people make their decisions. They prioritize things.
They do have their priorities in order. If it's about connectivity, they want to be connected.
Exactly. Exactly right. So the when you go to the villages of China, some of these things will just surprise you, but you have to know where to go.
So basically what you're telling me is you're squatting over a what seems to be a basic, makeshift toilet, but boy, you got wireless.
Well, if you come with Wild China, we give you a porta potty.
Oh, so you come prepared.
Totally.
What's the biggest surprise other than that when people first come to China, when they see this sort of that incredible juxtaposition between traditional living and high tech? What else are you seeing in terms of changes? Because it's changing so rapidly here.
I think for people, the biggest shock is they always tell me, wow, it's so modern. That's one thing sort of people don't really imagine China to be.
Well, too many and people then, are still reading Perlesque Buck.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Yeah, followed by Wild Swan, followed by Chinese Lessons, which you'll talk about soon. So that's the first impression. And secondly, everyone reads the numbers about how big the Chinese population is, but you just don't have any concept of what that number means. And you show up in Beijing, you go like, wow, this is crowded. This is really crowded. And it challenges people's opinion of China when you go to a Chinese restaurant here. You go like, they don't taste like Chinese restaurant in hometown, in Chinatown, anywhere in America.
Well, most Chinese restaurants in your hometown in America are mostly Cantonese. You know, the old days of the barbecue ribs and the, you know, the Szechuan green beans, maybe, you know. But yeah. Here, it's if you're looking for authentic Chinese food, you don't find it in Cleveland. You come here.
Well, let me tell you about this one place that just completely, even when I went there, it blew my mind. It's this new hot pot place called Hai Di Lao, which means fishing from the bottom of the sea. And it's a hot pot in the middle for people to share. But the shocking thing is you go there for the food, but everyone goes there for the service. The line to wait for a table is 2 hour long. And so why would people wait? And they figured out they give ladies free manicure, and they have free snacks provided, and guys would sit around the table, you know, play games and do whatever.
While they're waiting for the table.
While you're waiting for the table. But they have a little table, like a cocktail table,
sure,
for you to play. And then once you are at your seat, they give you an apron, they take care of every detail of your food. And if they see you, Peter, one feature about you is going to prompt them to give you something. They come over and give you...
I'm afraid of this now. What do you think it's going to be?
What do you think it's going to be? We actually share that feature. They give you a wipe for your glasses.
Ah.
Because with the hot pot, the steam is going to blur your vision. And for me, with long hair, they give me a hairband. It's these little sort of caring gestures. It's not about the freebie, but it's the caring gestures. So it's very well known now as the place to go to really experience Chinese service.
And that's certainly a different experience because it's for people who want one-upsmanship, they want bragging rights, that's a restaurant you want to go to.
Absolutely.
Wow. And yet...
And it won't break the bank.
Right. And you don't... See, so attention, Americans, you don't have to come to Beijing to go to Starbucks, Subway, or McDonald's. They're here, but it's not really for you. That's not comfort food. Please understand that. When we come back, more with Mei Zhang and the Opposite House here in Beijing, China. Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide. And we'll give you a handy wipe for you, too, right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
52
now
minutes after the
Peter
hour,
Greenberg.
Peter Greenberg back with you here from the Opposite House in Beijing in China, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. Solving a lot of things on the air right now, Mei Zhang, who runs a wonderful little operation here called Wild China. The story that you just told me about the restaurant, that's pretty wild. I mean...
It is wild.
But let's talk also about preserving the culture itself. As modern as you want to be, you still want to preserve the culture. I remember coming here many, many, many years ago at the old Cathay Hotel before they changed it to the Peace Hotel. And that was not here. That was in Shanghai. And then, wildly enough, they opened up a little restaurant across the street from it called the Peace Cafe. And I walked in there, and it suddenly dawned on me. I wasn't even aware of it initially. It didn't even hit me that I was eating a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich and listening to Anita Baker on the speakers. And when I left, the maitre d', who had a perm, okay, said to me, "Did you like your meal?" I said, "Absolutely." He says, "Okay, see you later." I said, "Okay." He said, no, you're supposed to say, "In a while, crocodile." I went, oh no, please. You know. And when I first came to China, the Chinese were learning their English at that point, when it was now okay to learn English, by singing, you know, "Old MacDonald Had a Farm," and "She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain When She Comes." This like the little songs that we would sing as kids ourselves. I remember walking down the streets in Shanghai and walking across a bridge, and notice, and all of a sudden, I had this notion that there was somebody following me, but you didn't want to be like uncool and like turn around. And so I took 10 more steps, and I heard 10 more steps behind me, and I'd stop, and the steps would stop. And finally, I turned around. There were 40 people behind me who thought of me as a curiosity because I was tall, I had a beard, and they wanted to practice their English with me. And we stood there on the bridge just saying American phrases, right? That's not that doesn't happen anymore.
You didn't see me? I was one of the 40. That's how every Chinese person learned their English back then. Because there was no sort of live radio or anything, you could really get a sense of America. But now there's the internet. There are all these American movies playing everywhere. And if you walk around Beijing, no one will take a second look at you.
Well, I will tell you my experience that happened earlier today, and my engineer Mike Worrell is a witness to this. Not far from this hotel, there's an Apple store. And we went by just to see what was going on, because Apple stores are a curiosity for me, even in New York. There's always a line around the block that's just crazy stuff. And, I mean, I don't even own an iPhone, but I like to look at what they're doing. As I walk outside the Apple store, there are probably 12 to 14 Chinese gentlemen outside the store, not going in. They're selling iPhone 4S. Right? And I'm going, wait a minute. There's the store right there. It's 18 feet away, and outside the store, people are like doing bootlegged or smuggled iPhone 4S. So I walked in the store and said, what's that? He says, well, we only have the iPhone 4 in here, but outside, they've got the iPhone. I said, where is it smuggled from? He said, oh, United States. I'm going, wait a minute. We're smuggling from the United States now? Wow. That doesn't surprise you.
No, it doesn't. Well, I have my iPhone 4S.
Where'd you get it?
Australia.
Sure, likely story.
Well, the thing is, people in China now are very, very sort of fashion conscious, or they want to get the next newest piece of gadget before the Americans even get it, before it goes on the market. And that tells people that I'm special in some ways. And iPhones are cool. So I have an iPhone 4S. But
well, I'm honored that you'd be actually joining my show now because you have that. Yes.
I belong to a different league.
Thank you very much.
The iPhone owners.
Of course. But that goes throughout the entire Chinese lifestyle now when you consider how many millionaires there are in China now that we would consider millionaires. There are more millionaires in China, I think, than there are in the United States at this point based on our definition of the word millionaire. The Bentley Automobile Company in 2011, in the year that we're just ending right now, sold 1,000 Bentleys in China. That's unheard of. Who's buying them? It's one thing when you come to China and the hotel has a Rolls Royce or the hotel has a Mercedes and they pick you up if you're in a five-star hotel. But no, we're not talking about 1,000 hotels having Bentley. We're talking 1,000 people. Things are changing.
Things are definitely changing. Yeah.
But how do you see it manifested? It's a conspicuous consumption, but it's also a conspicuous display of wealth.
Well, I think Chinese, for the longest time, in traditional Chinese culture, you were told not to flaunt your wealth. And for probably 30-something years, as far as 10 years ago, Chinese people didn't really have a whole lot of wealth, individual wealth, to show. Yet Chinese are very status conscious. And that explains today why, say, the Louis Vuitton bags have a gazillion stores around China. And if you go to Paris, you go to Hong Kong, in front of the Gucci stores, the LV stores, the lines are all Chinese. Because even if I can skimp at home, I'll spend less than $1 for a bowl of noodle every day for the rest of the year, probably, or the rest of the month. But I'll have an LV bag just to show that.
And your iPhone 4S, of course.
Well, I don't. I don't own a Louis Vuitton bag. That I have to clarify.
But the bottom line is it's amazing to see that sort of transformation. But the good thing about it is you can still see the real China by going on some of the special tours that you do that do not involve a single Louis Vuitton bag. And the name of the tour group, of course, or the company is Wild China, and that's Mei Zhang. Mei, thank you for joining us. That music means we're out of time for this hour. For those stations leaving us, have a great rest of your weekend. For those stations sticking around, we got a whole lot more coming from the opposite house in Beijing, China. More of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide. With America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Around the world, the trip begins with a kiss. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard, Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Hope you're having a wonderful mid-December weekend wherever you happen to be. Only 7 more days until somebody's coming down your chimney. Hard to believe it. Okay, I will say it. I don't want to admit it. Summer's over. But that means it'll start soon enough. Peter Greenberg here with you, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. Lots of stuff to talk about, but first, let me tell you where we are. Last week, we were coming to you from the Jefferson Hotel, the legendary Jefferson Hotel. Lots of history there in Washington, D.C. Today, got out your maps, boys and girls. 39 degrees, 55 minutes north, 116 degrees, 23 minutes east. Yes, we've been on a long-haul flight. We're coming to you from Beijing in China, from the opposite house. And as I said before, taking your calls and your emails, which I'm going to get to in a second. A couple of things in the news I want to talk about. Here's one that's not surprising to me, but gets me angry all the time. Would you believe the airline industry is again asking the U.S. Department of Transportation for more time, now a full year, to comply with portions of the DOT's new rules on the disclosure and implementation of baggage fees? You don't need a year to comply with this. Just tell the truth. Three words. It doesn't take long to pronounce. Tell the truth. It's called transparency. Now, they adopted the new rules in April under the DOT, and it set an August date. Then they changed that to next month in January because the carriers claimed they needed more time to reprogram their systems. Reprogram your system. It's called tell the truth. Now they're saying, the airlines are saying, that the five-month delay was just not nearly enough. At what point are somebody going to get smart and realize that airlines just want to delay it so they don't have to tell the truth? Enough of this. I mean, look, here's what the rules are. One requires the airlines to disclose in your online receipt and on your e-ticket confirmations the specific fees and allowances that apply to your particular itinerary. And the DOT has stated that the disclosure cannot be a mere list of the standard fees and allowances, which are already posted on the airline websites. Instead, they've got to explain the various factors, such as credit card usage or frequent flyer status, that can affect the policy that the airline has towards carry-on items on the first or second bag that you might be checking in. Now, the second rule stipulates that on multi-segment itineraries to or from within the United States, the same allowances and fees must apply throughout. That's it. That's going to take the airlines another 5 months to figure that out? Come on, guys. We weren't born yesterday. And look, we vote with our wallets. Anytime you see the airlines with one of those charges that make you want to opt out of something, do it. Because otherwise, you've opted in, number one. And number two, force them to make their case. Force them to explain to you what the fees are. Because every airline wants to be competitive on rate. How many of them are competitive on value? And not too many of them are competitive on the truth. So there you have it. But bottom line is, you have every right in the world to demand transparency. And then if you want to pay the bag fee, you go ahead and pay it. Or do what I do. Remember, there are only two kinds of airline bags, carry-on and lost. And on domestic flights, do what I've always done. I FedEx or UPS my bags 3 days ahead, ground service. And for about $20 more than the airline wants to charge me for losing my bags in the first place, guess what? I get door-to-door service, and I save at least an hour and a half, if not 2 hours of my life, by not schlepping that stupid bag. Simple as that. All right, let's go to your emails. We've got one from Jane in Chicago. Could you advise me as to travel in Jamaica? It's been since the early 80s since I've been to Jamaica. It's always been my favorite island. My last trip, I went alone and never had a threat or worry. Over the years, I've heard of some tourists who've been robbed and the atmosphere has changed. I'd rather stay in a resort that does not keep you on the property, such as an all-inclusive. Is staying in Jamaica changed if you want to stay in a non-all-inclusive? Well, let's get down to the definition of the words all-inclusive. Most of these resorts really aren't anyway, because the words all-inclusive are usually followed by a dreaded asterisk, letting you know what's not included in the all-inclusive. But forgetting that, I applaud you, Jane, for wanting to get outside the resort. Most of my fellow American travelers will go to a resort and never leave the gates. They'll just stay on the beach with a pina colada stuck up their nose and just veg for 7 days. How unexciting and visionless is that? The best thing is that every resort has a concierge. Every resort has tour operators that will take you out for some great personal experiences. No matter where you're staying, if you're in Montego Bay, they'll get you over to Ocho Rios. If you're in Ocho Rios, they'll get you over to Negril. They'll get you out on the water, not just on some jet ski, but on a great day-long cruise. And of course, once you get outside the resort, you get to go to some of my favorite places like Scotchy's. That's right. It's a traditional jerk chicken place where they're still using the corrugated tin and the smoke is everywhere and they're drinking Red Stripe. And when you're not looking, they're putting hot sauce on it that's going to require more Red Stripe. Bottom line is, that's what you want to do. And in many cases where I've stayed at those resorts, I've actually led expeditions. I'll use the word in a funny way, but expeditions of my fellow guests who didn't want to leave the resort just to go to Scotchy's to get food to bring back to the resort to eat in a more authentic way. Because why would you want to go all the way to Jamaica to have a cheeseburger? I don't know. A lot of people do. That wouldn't be for me. So, yes, you can still stay in Jamaica, Jane, in a non-inclusive resort, defined not by them, by what you do instead, okay? Here's one from Peggy in Jackson, Mississippi. I booked a cruise with a travel agency in June, picked out a certain cabin, midship outside. I've been cruising since the 80s. My husband just filled out the docks yesterday to make your boarding easy. They do not have our cabin on the docks. Holland America does not have us assigned to the room, but the travel agent gave me the confirmation of that particular cabin with a deposit. So my question is, what's your question? Well, the agency said they would get back to me. I do not want to put this in front of the ship due to sickness. What would you do? Very simple. At this point, if your travel agency doesn't help you, then they're not being your agency. In fact, they're being pathetic. You can call the 800 number for Holland America. You have a confirmation number, which your agency gave you, and say, hey, what cabin am I in? You also know, based on the brochure that you were given, on the actual catalog from the cruise line, they have a schematic of every cabin on the ship. You'll know right away if you've got what you need. But the bottom line here is, and this is for all my friends who are travel agents, you always get angry at me because you think I'm anti-travel agent. I'm not. I'm anti-bad travel agent. And this particular travel agency is being bad. You have a client to serve here with a legitimate question. They want a particular cabin on the ship. They've paid for it. If you can't give them the answer, you give them your commission back because you haven't done your homework. It's as simple as that. So get with it. Bottom line, though, you mentioned, Peggy, that you got a certain cabin midship outside. Here's my suggestion. You said you're worried about sickness. Do what I do. The best cabin on the ship is actually the cheapest cabin on the ship. It's inside middle cabin, lower deck, lower center of gravity, no pitch, no roll. And by the way, if you're paying for that ocean view from your balcony, be honest, that balcony is about as big to fit Mickey Rooney on there. And if he's lucky, all right, you're not going to spend much time in your cabin other than sleeping and showering. So get the inside middle cabin, save some money, lower center of gravity, no pitch, no roll. And the best part of the deal is, you leave the cabin and spend all your time outside when you want to be outside. So, but back to that travel agency deal again. Attention, travel agency, do your work, you know, deal with your client and get them the information they want. When we come back, we're going to be talking about seriously changing China. I've been coming since 1972, about a year after Richard Nixon came, and boy, have things changed. But they were changed by 1974. They're even more changed now, and if you're not careful, you might not even think you're in China. But coming up, we're going to talk about the whole relationship history between the United States and China, which has also changed rapidly and will certainly be on the cutting edge of everything that happens in your life, whether you ever come here or not, in the years to come. So more from the opposite house in Beijing with Peter Greenberg Worldwide when we come back.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the opposite house in Beijing, China, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. And as I do every week at this time on the show, I encourage you to go to our website, petergreenberg.com, for one very important and essential reason, and that's to find our archived and comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that great work in Haiti, in Western China, in Christchurch, New Zealand, in Japan, of course, and in parts of Chile as well. All places that were hit by either earthquakes or tsunamis in the last 2 years or so. And in the case of Haiti, and certainly in the case of Japan, we're talking about a massive rebuilding effort that cannot be and can never be done overnight. In the case of Haiti, we're talking at least another 8 years. And as rapidly moving as the Japanese are, Once again, they need your help as well. And the best part of this list is not only will you see things that you can definitely relate to, whether you're a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, things that you can literally bring to the party by crafting your own volunteer vacation, but a number of these organizations, if you're listening to the show and you have kids over the age of 8, they get to go along with you. It's a life-changing moment for them, and the best present you could ever give yourself is the present you give to somebody else by crafting and structuring a volunteer vacation. And I know some of you basically want to go do one day of volunteer work, 6 days at the spa, and 1 day of volunteer work. That's okay, too, but you need to get out and see for yourself what you can do to help, because it is truly an essential part of the travel experience these days, and I heartily endorse it. So once again, check our website, petergreenberg.com, for that comprehensive list of all the places, organizations, and experiences you can have. As I said right before the break, the relationship between the United States and China is pivotal. It's changing rapidly. It's intensifying by the hour. We're not on the brink of anything right now. We're on the brink of a lot of things right now. And joining me now, someone who knows a little bit about that, the former diplomatic correspondent for the Washington Post and the former bureau chief in China for the Washington Post, John Pomfret. Hey, John.
Nice to be here, Peter.
And you live here as well. So
I do. This is
the man to come see about this. And you're working on a book about this right now.
I'm writing a book about the U.S.-China relationship that goes actually way back to the 1780s when we had our first interactions with China. We actually talk about taking coal to Newcastle. We took ginseng, American ginseng, to China as our part of our first trading enterprises.
Well, that'll teach them.
Indeed.
What was in the research of this book, I mean, and you have a good perspective here because you also live here, but in the research of this book, what were some of the bigger surprises that you had, like the ginseng story, that people would go, I had no idea?
One of the interesting surprises to me was that Chinese merchants in the early years of the 19th century, in the 1800s or so, early, made a lot of money doing a lot of trade with America, selling tea. And because they didn't have investment opportunities in China, they funneled that money through Boston banks and invested that in the United States. And so Erie Canal, the first railroad that moved people from the East Coast to Chicago, were all funded by Chinese investments, not Chinese labor.
Well, I was about to ask
right.
the Chinese
They did
labor
that
question.
Later on. They built the Transcontinental. That was later
right.
on. That was in
right.
the 1860s. But actually, Chinese capital was very active in America in the early years of the 1800s.
Who knew?
And who knew?
Wow.
Exactly. And so, I mean, whereas American capital in the 1970s and 80s was really important in China's development and modernization, actually Chinese capital back in the 1800s was important in America's modernization as well.
So we have to thank them.
Yeah, well, not necessarily.
Hey, come on.
They made a profit too, right? It was win-win.
It was. And now, I was saying earlier in the show, when I first came to China, I went, of course, here to Beijing first, then later to Shanghai. But when I first came here, it was, you know, everything was heated by coal.
Right.
If you wore a white shirt in the morning, by 11 o'clock in the morning, it was gray. I'm not exaggerating. It was. I would borrow a bicycle and just, you know, ride everywhere. And my favorite day of the week was Friday, because very close to the old Great Wall Hotel were all the embassies, and they would rotate the TGIF parties, either the Australian, the British, the Canadians, or the Americans. And of course, the best parties were not at the American embassy.
Of course not.
Never. In fact, they didn't even want me to show up there. But the Brits and the Aussies and the Canadians, come on in, have a Labatt's beer, you know.
The Irish.
And
the,
oh, excuse me,
right.
John, the Irish,
right.
Of course. Well,
right.
You're talking drinking there.
Right.
But because it was considered a hardship post.
Yeah.
Is it still considered a hardship post?
Well, in Beijing, yes and no. The air, it's not such a great situation here still. In fact,
yeah,
it's gotten
know.
Significantly worse, right?
I mean, look, the day before I was flying in here, I was told I probably wouldn't even be able to land.
Right. Beijing International was shut because of pollution.
I mean, how do you I understand visibility issues, but the air, I mean, it was black.
Right. Well, a lot of people, including the senior officials in the Communist Party, have air filters in their homes. So, you know, people just, you know, make do. And you have to, I mean, you come to China not for the air. You come to China for the excitement.
Let me write that down. That's going to be the motto on their new tourism promotion.
Right.
Don't come for the air.
Don't come for the air. Bring your own mask.
Well, China, it'll leave you breathless.
Exactly.
No?
More
no.
ways than one. No, but you come here for the excitement. You come here for the fact that this place is changing more rapidly than any society has probably in the history of modern man. I mean, they've, you know, over the course of my experience, I first came to China in 1980. And I've lived here four different occasions. And I've been blessed to see this place change from what you saw, which is effectively a fifth world country. I went to school in Nanjing Nanjing University from 1980 to 82, and the tallest building in Nanjing there was six stories.
Oh, I remember I sailed into Dalian, you know, with the old Port Arthur.
Right.
Right? Oh, my God. I mean, and the actual, or you go to, what is it, Shenzhen, which is the port city to Beijing, right?
Tianjin,
excuse me. And it was a ride that would take you 3 or 4 hours because there were very few cars on the road. It was just, but there, everything else is on the road.
Right.
Not anymore.
I mean, they've undertaken a highway building program that's rivaled what Eisenhower did in the States.
Yeah, talk about cement.
Yeah.
Concrete.
And the interesting thing with China is you look what they've done over the last 40 years, and they've taken our 150 years of modernization, industrialization in the States and compressed it into that period of time. But it's not just the building. It's also the social changes without the political changes. So the education.
Well, let's address this one at a time. Let's talk about the building, for example. Eisenhower's great quote was, America didn't build the interstate highway system. The interstate highway system built America.
Right.
And that's really what's happening here.
Very much so.
And I remember, speaking of Nanjing, landing at that airport about 3 years ago going, am I the only guy here? Because it was this brand new gleaming airport with 85 different jetways. I was the only plane on the ground. I figured, did they evacuate this place and not tell me? No, they were building ahead of what they needed.
Right. There's a lot of what they call overcapacity, but slowly that's going to be filled in as more Chinese people take more trains, more airplanes, buy more cars. I mean, if you look at Beijing streets, right, one would think this is a city built for the automobile, and it is. But now with the fact that 1,000 extra automobiles are added every month in Beijing, the place is choking.
Bottom line of that is, I remember when I came here the first time, the automobiles that were here were like East German, you know, or bad Russian cars.
Right.
And then you look today, when I landed at the airport just yesterday, the hotel picked me up in a Maserati. I
mean, boy, you got the Maserati service. That's pretty good, Peter.
Was I styling?
Yeah, you were styling. Yeah.
But the thing is, it's not unusual anymore.
No.
And so I guess the question is, when you see that kind of building, how many different new airports have they built? I mean, I've been seeing different numbers ranging from 20 to 40.
Right.
In cities that most Americans don't even know exist.
Right.
You know,
well, there's 100 cities in China with a population higher than 1 million people. But it's not just airports. It's
100
also
cities?
100 cities.
Whoa.
Over 1 million. So, and there's 30 with a population of over 3. China, as we know, has no shortage of people. But it's not just airports. It's nuclear power plants. I mean, they're building 50 nuclear power plants as we speak. It's coal-fired plants as well.
Because they've got some of the largest reserves of coal, if not the largest reserves of coal
right.
in the world.
Still 70% of their power is derived by coal, which is, you know, if you believe in global warming, leads one.
Let's see, that would explain perhaps the black air here in Beijing?
Yeah, partially.
It's
also burning garbage around the city. There's about 50 large garbage dumps that burn garbage around the city. They create a lot of pollution.
So we're really going a really good tourist brochure here today, aren't we?
Yeah. It's a changing country, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the great lion of the East now. It's rising.
Okay. What about it worries you?
In terms of I worry about China's stability because their political system is what it is. It's a one-party dictatorship, and those generally, when they have problems, have really serious problems for the rest of the people, for the people around them. And it's inherently an unstable system, and they understand that. And so I think that's a serious issue. I also worry about the change in society because it's changed so quickly. I mean, these are people who started believing in, you know, traditional communist values. Mao came along in 1949 and basically attacked traditional communist values. Deng came along in 1976 and said, forget traditional communist values. Let's all get money. Let's all get rich. And in the meantime, they've sort of lost their traditional Chinese values. And that's a difficult thing for them to grow. And so there's a search for meaning in China, which makes it a very fascinating place.
And you've got the Central Party members. But the thing I want to talk about when we come back are their kids and what they're doing with all that money. We'll be back with more with John Pomfret from the Opposite House here in Beijing, China. More of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. Vacation, So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
We're back 33 minutes after the hour from the opposite house here in Beijing, China. Peter Greenberg here with you and taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. We're talking with John Pomfer from the Washington Post, who not only lives here, but is writing a fascinating book about the entire history of U.S.-Chinese relations that go back to the 1780s. We talk about the conspicuous consumption, but we also want to talk about conspicuous display of wealth. One of the things you said earlier, John, 100 cities with more than 1 million people, 30 cities with more than 3 million people. How many millionaires these days? A lot.
An enormous number, and it's, you know, growing every day. There's a lot of money being made in China. And as you said, people like to flaunt it. The interesting thing is they like to buy the fancy thing, like the Beamer, the LV bag, et cetera, but they don't like to pay for services. And so you have these remarkable situations where the guy with the fancy BMW will drive around the block for a half an hour looking for a free place to park.
Wow.
So they want to show off, or they will, you know, live in not the greatest apartment, but at the same time, the stuff that they wear out of the apartment are all the quality brands.
This just sounds like a bad actress in Beverly Hills. You know, she's living in a Cracker Box apartment, but she's driving the Benz and she's got the bling.
Well, there's a nouveau riche quality about the place, which is totally understandable. I mean,
but isn't that, but it's almost counterintuitive when you think about what the image that the country itself is trying to project.
Yeah, but what China wants to project about itself and what it really is, that's one of the fascinating things about this place. Those two images, the gap between those two images is so immensely wide, it makes it actually quite fascinating. I mean, irony is not a word that exists in Chinese, but you see it every day on the street.
Back in 1986, I was taking a group of friends of mine. We were sailing through China. We started in Kobe in Japan, went through the Inland Sea of Japan, all the way around up through Port Arthur, Dalian, and then all the way down the coast, where stopping everywhere, right? And we went to this small little village. We were the first ship ever to dock there. And they had the kids coming out to sing in the band. And it was a small commune there that made light machinery. And the mayor wanted to show us, very proud of showing us their workforce. And so I was with a bunch of friends of mine, ranging in age from 30 up to 60, and they're significant others, and we're walking with the mayor and my two Red Army handlers, right, as we're going to go inside the commune to see what they're doing. And I'm not making this up, John. As we walk by, I noticed like a very decrepit basketball hoop, no net, kind of hanging there, and the rim was kind of down and kind of hanging. And I said to the interpreter, to the mayor, I said, "Oh, do you guys play basketball?" And they came back with the answer, "Yes, it's a very popular sport." I said, "Do you have a team?" "Yeah, we have a couple of guys who play." So here I am trying to be a diplomat. I go, "We would love to my guys would like to challenge your guys to a friendship match." And the Red Army guys are, "Not possible. We'll not put, not part of the agenda." And I said, "No, you must tell the mayor that I want to challenge him to a game." And they didn't want to talk to him. They finally did. And the mayor looked at me like, he just gave me this look like, "You're kidding me." I said, "No, let's do it." And I go, "Okay." All of a sudden, out of his pocket comes a cell phone, right? Makes a phone call, okay? And all of a sudden, we see coming over the hill about 1,000 people with folding chairs. And then we see the team. They're all 6'6", okay? This is like shaping up to be a very bad decision, right? They're all 6'6". And then they bring in these plexiglass backboards, and it's like, it's the NBA. They got refs in black and white. I'm going, "We are so dead here." And I said to my team, "Okay, look, we're going to lose now. We have no chance in this game. Don't try to show off. Smile. Let's get out as soon as we can." We had a great time, though. At the end, we gave them our shirts. They gave us their shirts. It was great. Now, here's the funny thing. We're on a cruise ship. It was the first time the cruise ship docked there. We were the only people on the ship who were not blue-haired ladies, okay? 7 days later, when the ship came in, the kids were there, the band was there, the entire team was there ready for their next match. And, of course, that didn't happen.
No.
But now, I mean, that was a lesson to me about never presume anything about China.
Indeed. I mean, the place is that's why I've been here, you know, over the course of 10 years of my life, because it just never ceases to fascinate. That's one of the reasons why I wrote my book, Chinese Lessons, because I wanted to see, basically, the book is about my classmates, guys I went to school with in Nanjing, and I used their stories to tell the story of China's rise. And those stories were endlessly surprising to me.
What are the dangers, though, with this kind of rapid expansion, with this kind of rapid growth, with this kind of rapid consumption?
Well, I mean, look at 19th century America. Was that a dangerous country? I mean, it was actually a great boon to world development, which is what China's been doing as well. China is driving economies around Asia. They're South Korea's biggest trading partner. They're Japan's biggest trading partner. They're ASEAN's biggest trading partner. If China goes down the tubes, right, the world economy is going to be significantly affected. But if China continues to rise, it's going to lift the boats around the world, including the United States.
Right. Well, speaking of that rise, that brings up that really bad word that starts with the B and ends with an E, the bubble.
Possible. I mean, the history of the United States in the 19th century was filled with bubbles, right? We had a huge recession, depression in the 1830s. We had a massive one in 1873. The 1890s were no picnic. And China's going to go through those similar bubbles as well. It's just that's what happens with an economy and a society that's changing so rapidly. The potential danger in China to the rest of the world is, one, their pollution, and two, the fact that we don't really quite know what China wants to be when it grows up, right?
Yeah, well, that's the Kyoto Protocols, too.
Right.
That's the biggest. That's the biggie. I mean, it's one thing to say to a country, to another world, we don't want to do this or we can't do this because we're not economically set up to do it. We're a quote-unquote developing country. I don't look at China in that way anymore as a developing country.
Well, I mean, there's you know, China contains many worlds, right? Beijing, Shanghai are not developing anymore. They're developed. But Ningxia, Gansu, those are developing. So it's a country with huge gaps inside itself.
And when we come back, we're going to talk to John. We're going to shift gears a little bit, figure out where he likes to go out, where he likes to eat, where he likes to play. And we come back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the Opposite House in Beijing, back right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the Opposite House in Beijing, China. We're talking with John Pomfret from the Washington Post. John, you're the perfect candidate for me now because you're an American expat, you're married to a Chinese woman, you're raising your kids here, you're living here. So I've got to ask the local question, where do you like to go when you hang out? Where do you like to go eat? Where do you like to go play? Give me something that you like to do that is not in the brochure, not in the guidebook.
Well, my wife is from Yunnan, and there's a...
Explain where Yunnan is.
Yunnan is in southwestern China. It's basically, on the U.S. map, it'd be where Arizona is. Except it's a lot more mountainous.
Except it's in China.
Except it's in China. So it's in the southwest.
Right.
It's near the Burmese border. It's very mountainous. And it's absolutely, it's where rhododendrons actually come from. And it's an extraordinarily...
Now that qualifies as a little known fact.
A little known fact. Yes. It's cut by four or five major rivers. And it's an enormously wonderful place, and 26 minorities live in the province, so it's not purely Han at all. So there's a lot of Tibetans, and there are actually Tibetan Catholics there, which is a very interesting subgroup. But they were proselytized by the French in the 19th century. There's also a lot of Protestant groups as well, Protestant minority groups as well. So it's a fascinating place.
So basically, it's a province of minorities.
It's a province of minorities. And so in Beijing, there is a government office, which is the provincial office of the government of Yunnan, and they have a restaurant. And the restaurant every day flies in food from Yunnan, special dishes, mushrooms especially that can be outrageously expensive. And we like to go there on Saturdays for lunch with our three kids. One, because my son has developed a fixation on a Yunnanese noodle dish, which proves his, you know, the fact that he's half Chinese. So he loves to eat it. And he's a relatively picky eater. And so we all like to go there and basically have a huge chow with friends.
Please tell me you're not eating at any American franchise food place here.
No, the Yunnanese, no, we don't act. Well, no.
Wait.
Peter, look, you know, when you have Chinese-American kids, there's an American in there. And
do the words Happy Meal ring a bell?
No, the words Pizza Hut ring a big bell. But I have to tell you, Pizza Hut in China, just to give you an example of how this country has taken American tradition and changed it, is a high-end meal. Right, the Pizza Huts in China are fancy. They're the place where, you know, young Wang will take young Zhang out on their first date. I mean, this is a place of romance in China. It's a different country, right? And so they've taken these, and I would think, you know, the companies that own Pizza Hut would actually rather have the Chinese franchise of Pizza Hut than that somewhat tattered American brand.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did they deliver?
They do. Actually, we got some tonight.
I love that. All right, so basically you're talking about this cool little Yunnan place and Pizza Hut.
And Pizza Hut.
Oh, you're in such trouble.
Yeah.
Okay. Give me another place that you guys like to go as an experience. Not to eat, but as an experience.
Well, let's talk about a place outside of Beijing. Northwestern Yunnan, which is up by the Tibetan border, or Western Sichuan, which is basically you go to Chengdu and you move west towards, in the Tibetan areas, is an area of high forest. It's not the Tibetan, it's moving up to the Tibetan plateau. I like to hike a lot. I like to backpack a lot. And you can get a horse pack there. You can get guys who will set up your tent. You can get guys who will set up your tent, walk with you, and, you know, kill a chicken and have that hot chicken stir fry waiting for you after you've hiked 15 miles. I mean, it's an absolutely gorgeous part of the world.
So you would describe this as a hot chicken stir fry hike?
A hot chicken stir fry hike, sleeping outside with hot cocoa in the morning. But you can do that for 4 or 5 days, and it's absolutely stunning.
And
there.
It's not expensive.
It's not expensive. Well, you know, the flight, it's actually, ultimately, it's not that expensive. But the fact is that it's kind of like taking a backpacking trip in the States, except you're walking through villages, from village to village. And so you're seeing village life in the midst of amazing scenery. And sometimes you bump into an incredible temple. A lot of Tibetan monks who are doing the kora, which are Tibetan pilgrimages in which they prostrate themselves in sort of a form of moving push-up as they move along. You see that as well. And so you get the amazing Chinese scenery in addition to Chinese culture at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hot chicken stir-fry hike.
Hot chicken stir-fry hike.
Not a bad deal.
Cocoa in the morning.
I got it.
All right.
Pizza Hut in the evening.
Indeed.
Oh, you're so... Now, tell me you're not driving a Mercedes.
No, we drive a GM car, a van, which...
See, now, GM's made big inroads here.
GM makes a lot of money. Well, China's the great star in GM, right?
Buick.
Well, and so we drive a van, actually, that costs more than the Lexus we owned and the Honda Odyssey we owned in the States, simply because... Again, back to the whole idea of Chinese love brands. And the interesting thing is, although in the States, the Chinese have a reputation as being somewhat of a sneaky business people, in reality, they overpay here for brands maximally, right? LV costs more, Lexus costs more, everything costs more in China, and the Chinese are willing to pay for it.
And be very careful because it might even be that Pizza Hut costs more.
It does.
John Pomfret from The Washington Post, thank you again for joining us.
Appreciate it.
We'll be back with more Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the Opposite House in Beijing right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from Beijing in China from the Opposite House. And when you think about it, there's a good reason why I guess they call it the Opposite House, because it's opposite from a lot of hotels you'd ever think of being hotels. Cutting-edge design, very Japanese in its design, very sparse in ways, but also quite beautiful in their use of wood. And when was the last time you were at a hotel that really used a lot of wood? Well, this one does. Anyway, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you absolutely know the drill by now. I know you do. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. Lots of emails to deal with, so let's go to them. We got one from Craig in Chicago. I've heard you speak about the Norwegian line. Which ship would be the best, Epic, Pearl, etc.? Well, you're talking about Norwegian cruise lines. Many of you may have seen the one-hour special we did a couple of years ago on CNBC on a week in the life of a cruise line. It was called Cruise Inc., and that featured the Norwegian Pearl. But their newest ship is the Epic. And what I particularly like about that ship, Craig, and I have no idea whether you're married or single or will be traveling solo or not, but so many of you listening to the show are solo travelers, and so many of you have been beaten up for years by that dreaded single supplement where you actually have to pay double the cost of a cabin if you wanted to travel by yourself. The folks at Norwegian, they get major kudos from me on this one. They finally figured out what we knew all along, that single people are a robust financial entity, and we do vote with our wallets. So when they built the Epic, they actually designed 128 separate cabins that could be sold as single cabins for single people. They didn't price them double the cost of a regular cabin. They priced them somewhere in the middle. It was a win-win for everybody. And guess what? Those cabins sold out immediately. And now, gee, what a surprise, lines like Royal Caribbean, lines like Celebrity are now thinking, and some of them actually announced, they're going to now incorporate the single cabin idea in many of their new ships, or even retrofitting some of their, their current ships. So, I like the Epic. I'm not a big ship fan, but it's a good ship. I also like the Pearl. I like the Pearl almost better, only because it's a much more manageable ship. And I like to joke all the time that some of these new ships are so big they've got high crime areas on board. But when you think about it, when you've got 7,000 people on a ship, you know, who knows what's going on? Anyway, bottom line on that is if you can get a single cabin, you go for it. Here's one from Robin in Coral Springs, Florida. After hearing about American Airlines filing for Chapter 11, is there any way I can protect the 70,000 air miles I've been saving? I'm a huge Barbara Streisand fan. I don't know what that has to do with American Airlines filing. But, oh, I see what she says. And I've been saving emergency air miles just in case she does another concert tour. Barbara, you had no idea how much this American Airlines filing is affecting your plans to go back out on the road. Anyway, Robin, the question is there any way I can transfer the miles to another airline? I'm so afraid I'm going to lose them. You have very little chance of losing your miles, Robin, but here's the problem. You have an exponentially decreased chance of being able to use them because as airlines shrink, and that's not just American, it's every airline, as airlines reduce capacity, that means there are fewer planes, fewer flights, and fewer seats. And the last thing an airline wants to do if it's filling all of its seats with revenue passengers is displace any of them by redeeming any of your miles. Right now, the redemption levels at most airlines are under 10%. And they're getting a return on their investment that the Sopranos would be jealous about. Mafia loan sharks would be jealous about it. So it's not a question of losing your miles. It's a question of your mileage becoming exponentially less valuable. So don't wait for Barbara to go on tour, okay? Even Barbara is going to be redeeming her miles before she goes out on tour. You get out there and figure out where you want to go in the next 330 days and lock that in now because 331 days from now, it'll be tougher for you to do it. So my advice, and it's serious advice, Robin, Barbara Streisand can sing, people who need people are the luckiest people in the world. Well, if you need mileage and you want to use mileage, you're about to be one of the unluckiest people in the world. So do it now. And then you'll catch up with a cheaper fare when Barbara finally makes her decision to come out of retirement for the 18th time and go out on tour. So that would be my suggestion there. Here's one from Toby. Last week I heard about finding hidden plane flights where the airlines need to move one plane from one airport to another, and you used a special term. What was that? Easy. It's called a positioning flight, Toby. Much like the cruise lines use something called a repositioning cruise. It's more important for the airline to move that piece of metal from point A to point B so it could become a huge revenue generator from point B to point C. The same thing applies to cruise lines when they reposition their ships. What they do is, at the end of every quarter, when they've got to get a ship out of the Mediterranean and move it to the Caribbean, when they've got to get a ship out of the Caribbean and move it up to Alaska, they've got to literally move the ship. And these are my favorite kinds of cruises because they're longer. You're not doing one port every 5 hours. You're not forced to go buy a straw hat or a stupid T-shirt. You actually get a chance to do a crossing. And some of these repositioning cruises are amazing. I mean, Carnival's got one from Barcelona to Galveston. Barcelona to Galveston? Yep, they've got one. It's about a 17-day trip. You may stop in one or two or maybe three ports along the way, but the rest of the time you have days at sea. You can think. You can relax. It's what the original cruise ship experience was all about. So any chance you get to take a positioning flight, you're going to save some money. And every chance you can get it to take a positioning ship, you'll save even more money. We did the fare comparisons on that 17-day cruise from Barcelona to Galveston on Carnival. You ready for this? The fare works out to $39 a day. That includes your three meals and all the things that the ship has to offer. Why wouldn't you do that? All right, that music means we're out of time for this hour. For those stations leaving us, have a great rest of your week. For those stations sticking around, we got a whole lot more coming from the opposite house in Beijing, China. We'll be back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. We'll be right back. Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Hope you're having a wonderful mid-December weekend wherever you happen to be. Yes, summer's now over. Sorry about that. But the bottom line is, we're having a great time. And if you get out your maps, I'll tell you where we are. Last week, we were at the Jefferson Hotel, the legendary Jefferson Hotel in Washington, D.C. We got on a few little long-haul flights to get to where we are now, but, of course, the trip was worth it because we're coming to you from 39 degrees, 55 minutes north, 116 degrees, 23 minutes east. We're coming to you from Beijing in China at the Opposite House, an amazing hotel that never could have ever possibly existed here 20 years ago. How times have changed. We're taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem, and we'll solve it right here on the air. One of the letters I've gotten recently was from a very angry listener, and by the way, I share her pain. She wrote in that it was bad enough last year when Spirit Air basically was going to charge up to $45 for a carry-on bag, when all the other airlines, of course, were already charging for checked bags. She said, now they've gone one step further. They're actually charging you. Now, this makes absolutely no sense, unless you're Spirit Air, of course, up to $34 just to book your flight online. Now, the reason why that makes no sense, of course, is that the airlines would tell you that one of the things they're trying to do is cut down their labor costs by getting rid of the people who answer the phone to begin with. So they're encouraging you to not pay a tariff of talking to somebody on the phone by booking online. Every airline does that. So if you talk to a human being, gee, what a concept, a real human being at American Airlines, that can cost you up to $30 for the reservation. Same thing with United, same thing with Delta, and many other airlines. They say, oh, but if you book online, it's free. Spirit, not to be outdone in the stupidity ranks, meaning the stupidity would be you if you did this, is saying to you, oh, if you book online with Spirit, it'll charge you up to $17 each leg. So there's your $34. The only way you can avoid that $34 round-trip charge, and this is where it gets nasty, is you have to go to the airport. This is to book the flight, not to take the flight, to book the flight, and go up and stand on the world's longest line behind or in front of the world's most tired ticket clerk, because there's probably only one of them, to book your flight. Your cab fare to the airport alone is more than $34. So, and they know that. So here's my Christmas wish list. It's for Spirit to be taken out for re-education to somewhere near Siberia, to understand that this is a declaration of war against consumers. And I've said this before, and anybody from Spirit who wants to come on this air and debate me, you have the green light. My phone lines are open. Come into the studio, whatever you want to do, and explain to me why your advertising motto shouldn't be, "We're not happy until you're not happy." Enough of this. I'm sorry, guys, but you are getting me to the point of a declaration of war right back at you and letting people know that it'll be a long day before I will fly Spirit, just on principle alone. There's nickel and diming, and then there's nickel and diming on steroids. Enough is enough. And Ryanair is pulling it overseas in Europe with a booking fee online. They're doing it because they can. And the reason why they can is you, that's right, you listening to me right now, are stupid enough to pay it. If we basically all said we're not paying that, listen, I have no problem if they want to charge me $30 more for the flight. Okay, fuel's expensive. I get that. But don't give me an unrealistic airfare just so that you get my attention to then go out and insult me. This is an insult. It's wrong. And here's the Department of Transportation asking the airlines to actually be transparent. They actually have a rule saying we want you to be transparent and list what all these charges are. And what are the airlines doing? Saying, oh, it'll be too costly for us to implement them right away. Oh, stop me from laughing, please. And then they ask for a three-month delay, and then another delay. And now they're asking for a five-month delay to basically not tell the truth? Wow. You know, I've been a fan of deregulation since 1978 for all sorts of important reasons. However, the one thing I'm not a fan of is that deregulation does not allow a single attorney general in any one of the 50 U.S. states to use their consumer affairs office to basically monitor the stuff the airlines are doing that don't just border on. They are bait and switch. They are extortion. They are not. There are untruth in advertising. And that's unfortunate because there's no regulation of that on the federal level, and there's no regulation of that on the state level. They get to run wild and rampant. The only thing that can stop them is you, by voting with your wallet and saying, like the old movie network, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore. We've already started that battle when it comes to check bags. We will do anything. And if you're listening to me now, you know I'm right. You know you do it. We will do anything we can to sneak our bag through security, I don't care how big it is, just so we can get it to the gate, so not have to pay for the checked baggage fee. And then, of course, when we get it to the gate, it's clearly obvious it will never fit in the overhead compartment. So then the airline will say, okay, we'll have to gate to check that, but they don't charge you. It's a total great scam that we play, except for the poor guys on the plane who were stupid enough to pay for the checked bag fee to watch all of us get away with it. I was on a Delta Airlines flight the other day going from New York to Los Angeles. I watched them have a delay of 40 minutes on the ground because they had to gate check 53 bags and then stop the almost fisticuffs that were coming around with all the passengers on the plane saying, well, why'd you charge me? And you know what? They have a point. Why should they charge anybody? Look at Southwest Airlines. They've branded their entire company around the idea that they don't charge for checked bags. And yes, they may have left $700 million of revenue on the table, but they generated more than $1.5 billion in additional revenue because it spoke to us. That policy resonated with us. We basically said, wow, I'm going to fly that airline just because I'm so angry at having to fork over up to $120 every time I do a round-trip flight for my two checked bags. Now, in fairness, if you do a fare-by-fare comparison on the routes where Southwest Airlines competes against American or United or Delta, guess what you're going to find? Surprise, surprise. Southwest Airlines fares are as expensive or not even in some cases more expensive than their competitors. But they enjoy a great reservoir of residual passenger goodwill because none of us feels we've been nickel and dimed. None of us feels we've been hosed. And there's a lot to be said for that, not just in the airline business, but in the hotel business. There's a hotel in London called the Athenaeum. I like that hotel. We've actually broadcast on that hotel. What's their biggest negative touch point? That stupid minibar, that Darth Vader minibar, where you even look at the Diet Coke it charges you. The manager there at the hotel said, look, we're angering our guests, and we also want to raise our room rates, but we don't want to generate it from, like, Diet Coke. So you know what they did? They actually physically removed, throughout, all those Darth Vader minibars and replaced them with refrigerators. And what did they put in the refrigerator? Every cookie, every candy, every chocolate bar, every milk, every juice, every soft drink, everything that's non-alcoholic, and made it free. They raised their room rates 20 pounds a night, and guess what happened? Their occupancy went up 17% with very happy people. You know why? Because when you're walking back or driving back to that hotel after a busy day of meetings, you are visualizing that chocolate chip cookie. You're dreaming about that chocolate chip cookie because you know it's in that refrigerator. You want it so badly. And for the first time, guess what happens? You know you don't have to go to your wallet to have it. You know you can actually enjoy it without getting hosed. So to all my friends at Spirit Airlines, of which there are probably now none, you know why. Stop the stupid online booking charge, because you do so at your own peril every time I go on the air. When we come back, more from the Beijing Opposite House with Peter Greenberg Worldwide. And I wasn't being opposite at all. I was being positive. I was being forthright. We'll be back right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
And we're back. 18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, please email me. To Peter at PeterGreenberg.com with your name, your phone number, your question, or your problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. And as I do every week at this time, I encourage you to go to our website, petergreenberg.com, for a comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that essential hard work in Haiti, in Western China, in Japan, in Christchurch, New Zealand, and in Chile. All of those locations affected so badly by either earthquakes and or tsunamis in the last 2 years. And as I say every week, please look at that list, because you will be more than pleasantly surprised to learn all the different ways you can involve yourself up close and personal on location in these destinations and actively participate in the rebuilding efforts that are so desperately needed. And if you're listening to the show and you've got kids over the age of 8, there are programs that allow them to go with you. What an amazing experience for your kids, and an amazing experience for you to watch your kids have that kind of experience. So please go to our website, petergreenberg.com. Check out that list. Whether you're a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, I don't care. There is something there for you. And when you do go on these trips, when you do structure a volunteer vacation around this, give us a call at 888-887-3837 or 888-88-PETER. Call into the show and let us know what you're doing and how you're doing, because I want to hear that excitement on the phone, because I guarantee you, you will be. As I said at the opening, we're coming to you from the opposite house here in Beijing in China. And so many people come here to immerse themselves to the extent that they can in the history, in the music, in the culture, in just the development of a country that's so rapidly growing. And then, of course, there are the arts. And joining me now is somebody who knows a little bit about that, since she moved here from Boston. Her name, Meg Maggio. She's the director of Pekin Fine. Did I pronounce it right?
Yes.
Pekin Fine Arts. How are you?
Very, very well. Thank you.
How long have you been here in Beijing?
I've been in Beijing since 86.
So you've seen it all change. Oh, my goodness.
In between, I lived in Hong Kong and Shanghai for 5 years.
I know, but Hong Kong is a whole different story ever since the handover in 97. But we're talking just mainland China here, unreal change. I mean, could you ever see it happening this fast, honestly, looking back?
No. I mean, compared to the 80s, absolutely no way. I would have never imagined this.
So when you moved here in 86, I have to ask the three-word question, why?
I was a student. I was at law school. I was terribly bored. I worked in Hong Kong in the summers of law school. And then after law school, I moved to Beijing in 86 to study language.
So let me see if I get this right. And I didn't read this ahead of time. When you were in law school or hanging out in Hong Kong, you'd take a little day trip in, wouldn't you? You'd go to Canton or
yeah.
See, I got you. You did. And you initially did it just to go shopping, didn't you?
No shopping then in Canton.
No, well, they had the friendship store. They had the friendship store. I remember the first time I came to China, they had a friendship store. Everything was green.
Right.
It was a green bag, a green hat, a green thing with a little red star. That was it. And it was friendship.
Yeah.
That was it. Now, Gucci, Pucci, Schmoochie.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah. So, but once again, you've seen this thing change so rapidly. Some people would argue it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Some people would say, whoa, it's changing too fast. And in relation to what you do, in terms of preserving the culture, makes your job a little tougher.
Well, I think it's very exciting. I mean, I'm very bullish about the Chinese contemporary art scene, and I think
because they're able to express themselves in ways they couldn't do before.
And there's such a wealth of creativity and such a deep talent pool. And contemporary art needs speed and it needs rhythm, and things move quickly in the contemporary art world, and that's always a good thing. You don't want things to move too slowly.
When you talk about contemporary art and you look at the evolution of other countries that allowed contemporary art as we know it to evolve, one of the things that you see here is an opportunity to express, to reflect the change that's happening. Mm. What have you seen the difference in the contemporary art since you first got here?
Well, when I first started collecting Chinese contemporary art, which was in the 80s, soon after I arrived in 88, 87, I think I bought my first pieces of traditional ink painting that were contemporary language using traditional medium, oil painting. Now there's such an explosion of creativity across every medium, and there's so much more diversity, and the talent pool is so deep, and there's a lot of exchange around the country between the artists and also around Asia between the other Asian countries. So a real mature conversation takes place now.
Well, what you're seeing, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're seeing is more mobility. And now in this global village, people can literally leave where they are and experience something else, which they then reflect in their art.
That's true. And Beijing has very much become the international, regional, and national platform for all of those conversations. So you have artists from all over the country moving to Beijing. You have artists from all over Asia living in Beijing and artists from around the world living in Beijing. So that makes it the most international platform for contemporary art in Asia.
But when you think about it, whenever I go shopping now, right, I'm seeing different expressions in the paintings than I saw 20 years ago on the faces, right? Because if you go back to the traditional Chinese art of even the Mao generation, it was always the happy farmers in the field with their arms raised and celebrating the harvest, right?
That's true. That's more of the official art.
Exactly.
Yeah. And now there's no longer that divider. You don't think of official and unofficial art. Now there's just a sort of wide open field, and everyone can play on that field. So there's an enormous amount of diversity now, and an enormous amount of individual expression.
Okay, stupid question. Here it comes. We know that the Chinese is they're one government that's very clearly worried about the Arab Spring. They're very clearly worried about people being able to assemble, people able to express their feelings, people able to communicate, very very considered about the use of the internet, very worried about it. If they could possibly limit it more, they would. They've even blocked my blog on the internet. But with contemporary art, how do they control that? Because it's so interpretive.
Well, I don't think they're that interested in controlling it. I think they're also worried about the fact that they get criticized by the rest of the world for lack of creativity and mass production and lack of originality. So I think now there's been a real shift in the cultural policy towards creative industries and supporting grassroots designers, grassroots artists, just to and also to support exhibits abroad. I mean, in the last year...
Doesn't that fly in the face of the party?
No. Because I think they've got enough self-confidence now based on their economic success. They're full of self-confidence, and they want the rest of the world to appreciate Chinese culture. And that was
That's a sea change.
And that, if I had to sort of date that, I would date it to before the Olympics, because I think part of the pitch in getting the 2008 Olympics was to package Beijing. When they had to sell Beijing to the rest of the world to get the Olympics, how did they sell Beijing? As the cultural capital of Chinese culture.
Now,
the capital of Chinese culture.
I gotcha. and if you look at the sheer numbers, which are staggering, I mean, they're really staggering, 25 years ago, right, which is basically, when you got here, right, 86, I mean, Chinese didn't travel.
They did not travel. They didn't even travel domestically.
Right. So as an artist, your field of vision, your frame of reference, if you were, was really limited.
Yeah, but they had a pretty mature art academy system. So people flocked to the art schools if they were lucky enough to get accepted into the art schools.
Right. Now that it's open up to more people, but now they get to travel. It reminds me of a story that happened when I was in Shanghai one day. I actually sailed into Shanghai. A guy rode up to me on his bicycle. He looked like he was 50 years old. Found out later he was 82. His name was Joe Chang. He goes, "Are you from the ship?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Hi, how are you?" And I said, "Wow, your English is remarkable, Joe. Where'd you learn?" He said, "I learned it here." I said, "Really?" I said, "You lived here all my life." I said, "I'm not going to go on the bus tour tomorrow. I want to go with you. Why don't you take me on your tour of Shanghai?" And the story that he told me was an amazing story, much like Nan Cheng's book, Life and Death in Shanghai, where he was the only person that his family allowed to be educated in English because they didn't think that the women should be educated, only the men. That was the way it was in those days. He ended up working for British American Tobacco. When World War II ended, he was the driver for the admiral on the Missouri, who then said to him, "Why don't you come and be my driver in Hawaii?" He says, "Oh, there'll be time." And then the revolution came, and he was banished to the countryside because he spoke English. And I wrote a story about him. And his big dream was to go to New York, and they wouldn't give him a visa to leave, and they wouldn't let him go out. And so I wrote a story about him, and the next year I came back and through an interpreter, because remember, he was the only one in his family who spoke English. So I called the number that I had for him, and we said, "Oh, is Joe Chang there?" "No, he not here." "Where is he?" "He in New York." he got the visa.
Right.
And so now people actually have a chance to travel.
That's true.
And with that comes a whole new perspective on the art.
Yeah, and most of the artists are very sophisticated. They've traveled everywhere. They've traveled all around Asia. They've traveled all around China. They've exhibited their work internationally. So the art world has sort of jumped ahead of a lot of other fields where they're really competing now with international art centers around the world.
And what you're really telling me now, whether you want to say it or not, I'm going to say it, art has become the new diplomacy.
Soft diplomacy, as they like to call it.
Yeah.
It has. And Chinese art is sort of at every museum in major cities.
Meg, stay with me for a second. We'll be back with you in just a second with more Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the Opposite House in Beijing, China, right after this.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837. or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with Meg Maggio, who's the director of the Pekin Fine Art. I love saying that, Pekin Fine Arts Gallery here in Beijing. What's the most, which would constitute in your mind, one of the most unusual pieces of art that you've seen that is reflective of all the changes you've seen in China?
I mean, I think our gallery is a piece of art. Our gallery, the architecture and design is designed by Ai Weiwei, and it's just a splendid design. A very nice architect to artist. Ai Weiwei was one of the stars, stars art movement of during the end of the Cultural Revolution in the 70s. And after being part of that movement, he went to the United States and lived in the United States from the late 70s to the mid 80s. And then he moved back to China. And in some ways, he's become a sort of Andy Warhol of the Chinese contemporary art movement. He's one of the first artists who really used in a very creative way the media for his message. And he's been described as an activist artist, but I don't think that really does justice to his tremendous talent and creativity. And he became very well known here for organizing exhibitions and later opening an architecture firm which helped to design with Herzog and de Meuron, the Swiss architects, the Bird's Nest at the Olympic Stadium. Wow. And he's been very active in designing art galleries around our district. And the galleries are based on the idea of the old hutongs and the old courtyard streets.
And where is he today?
Today he's home. He's down the road from our gallery in his home.
Somewhat controversial.
Yeah, he's been. He was detained for 81 days by the Beijing
that
police.
That would be somewhat controversial.
That was tough.
And detained for what?
None of us are really sure. I think it's because the way that he's decided to speak out on behalf of families whose children have died in the Sichuan earthquake, and for his sort of aggressive stance on identifying those children and getting a list of names of those children.
But even while he's been detained, he still does his art.
He's never stopped to do his art, and he does great art. He does art every day of his life. He's a great artist.
Okay, so give me another example of a piece that you either have on display or one that you've actually been able to sell, or that has been mm-hmm. exhibited, that's traveled, that is sending a new message.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a lot of very exciting artists here who have been involved in shows that have traveled around the world. We did an exhibition a couple of years ago with an artist named Li Jin at the Seattle Art Museum. And then that was really fun because the work had started at the Hammer Museum in L.A. There was a show called International Paper. And he did a painting which is 50 feet long, which is about the Chinese banquets. And it's a sort of reinterpretation of a traditional scroll painting, but very contemporary. And it's 50 feet of Chinese food at a banquet. And that piece, the life of that piece and the way that piece has migrated is very typical of the way the Chinese artists have migrated. From the Hammer Museum group show, it was picked up by the Seattle Art Museum for a solo show. Seattle collected the work. Curators from the Berkeley Museum saw the work. They collected other work. The Henry at the University of Washington, they collected other work. And now the artist was recently in a show at the Boston Museum, and he's still a professor here at the Tianjin Art Academy. And in the 80s, he was a young professor in Tibet. So the way these guys have sort of moved around not only their own country but the world, and now the way they're teaching the next generation of artists is really exciting to see.
Well, when you talk about teaching the next generation of artists here in Beijing, you talk about going to the art academies here. How many Americans now are coming here to study?
Many, many, many. And at the art academies, not only the art academies, but also the universities, there's a lot of Americans who are coming here on study programs, and also a lot of the museums are coming here. So the museum directors are coming here. They're bringing their board members and their curators, and they're doing projects in China. So they're doing international exchange projects, curating shows here, taking artists from China, doing shows here, taking them out of China. So this international conversation between the art world outside China and inside China is a weekly event.
Well, speaking about that conversation in the art world, we're coming from a hotel called The Opposite House, mm-hmm. which is in itself almost an art gallery.
Yeah.
I mean, you walk in and you're surrounded by everything short of performance art.
Yeah, you know, it's wonderful. And they've turned the main lobby into an art gallery. So there's revolving exhibitions about every 2 months.
I mean, when you walk into
most
hotel lobbies, you look for the front desk.
Yeah.
I can't find the front desk at this lobby.
Yeah.
I walk in the lobby here and I'm looking at exhibits and I'm looking at something that's moving or something that's static, but you go, why is it there?
Yeah.
I mean, right? It's kind of fascinating.
And Taro Ando, the man who designed the hotel, has designed a lot of museums. And part of the ethos of the Swire Group and also of Taro Ando is that the hotel has to collect art and has to have an art collection. So they have a permanent collection.
But the stuff that's in the lobby, it's wild.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an exhibit right now where you're encouraged to participate,
yeah.
to go over and take a photograph of just your eyes.
Yeah, by Moyi, who I just saw, he was here in the lobby tonight. So he's here every day interacting with guests, which is very nice.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen? Now, does that exhibit travel then when it's done? Or?
No, it's just a one-off thing. I mean, Beijing has this incredible talent pool. There's probably over 1,000 artists living in Beijing. So there's a lot. It's nice that they offer this platform to artists.
Not bad. Mm-hmm. So you don't only just check in. You get to check out before you even go to your room. You just check it all out.
Right. You know, you can't avoid art in this hotel.
And the real performance art is just getting to your room.
Yeah. It's wonderful. I mean, you really feel that you're in a sort of mini museum here.
Which is nice, especially when you're not expecting it. I have to
yeah.
not expecting it at all. Meg Maggio, the director of Pekin Fine Arts, great gallery. And for those of you listening to the show in Boston, we found her. She's here.
You can still hear her accent.
Right. And we'll be back with more from The Opposite House in Beijing, China, with more Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from The Opposite House in Beijing, China, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-Peter. This coming segment, I have to tell you, is the fun part of the show because I always like to see a different city in a very different way. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was in Sydney, and I said to the chef one day at the hotel, which was the Park Hyatt, you guys do anything different about seeing Sydney? I mean, is there any kind of... He said, well, actually, if you want, I can make you a picnic lunch and pack it in a basket, and then I can call a couple of friends of mine, and they'll take you on a tour. I go, well, that sounds great. Why don't you do that? So he packs the picnic, but he forgot to tell me something. The two friends showed up on Harleys. And so me and my partner at the time end up on the back of these Harleys, holding on for dear life. We saw Sydney in a completely different way. And my next guest is doing the exact same thing here in Beijing. He's the owner of Beijing Sideways. And if you want to know what that means, well, I'm going to tell you in a second, you're going to be seeing Beijing from the inside of a sidecar. How cool is that? His name, Gail Thoreau. Hey, man, how are you?
Oh, hello, Peter.
I mean, the Chinese have been making, I know this for a fact because the King of Jordan actually showed me his Chinese sidecar, which he bought here in Beijing and bought like four of them. So the Chinese are still manufacturing sidecars.
I think that they just stopped to do them, but they still have a lot of parts on the still assembling them.
They're
so
still machining them.
You can
them,
still
yeah.
get yeah, very a new one.
So how did you come up with this idea that you're going to whip people around town in a sidecar? I love it.
I didn't come with the idea just to make it as a business. I just did it at the first time with friends and going to the Great Wall, going to for weekends. Just as the sidecar was my means of transportation for many years. Well, I had a friend who was coming quite often to Beijing, and more or less I was wondering if he came from here for the sidecar tours, and he was for the sidecar tours, and he just told me, well, you should make people pay for that.
What a concept, okay.
Yeah, you know, you never want to do something as pleasure. It's difficult sometimes to accept that, yeah, you can charge for that. And then
explain the sidecar. What is it? How big is it?
It's a 750 engine. So it seems very powerful like that, but it's
and it's Chinese made.
It's Chinese made, yeah. But the conception comes from the BMWs that you can see in all the World War II movies.
Of course.
So very old conception, so not that much horsepower behind.
Where do you go? I mean, you could actually go places other people can't go, too.
We can go, yeah.
Especially considering Beijing traffic, you can kind of maneuver.
There's a lot of bicycle lanes exactly for us.
Go on the bike lane?
Beat the traffic.
Oh, yeah. I love it. All right, so
on the hutongs, Beijing is a city with a lot of hutongs, which are those narrow lanes.
Yes.
It's a traditional authentic streets that used to be like 30 years ago when you first came.
That would have been a very bumpy ride.
Exactly.
A very bumpy ride.
It still is. but those streets are just made for the cyclists. You can't really go with them on cars or bicycle. I love bicycle in Beijing as well. But the sidecars allow you to cover a lot of ground.
Okay, so you're covering a lot of ground, using Beijing as your hub. How far do you actually go on these tours?
Well, we have different tours. We have one day tour to the Great Wall. Well, I was afraid you would say the same for Sydney, but for this one day tour, we also do picnics.
There you go.
And then you can have them.
I think it would be a great idea to take a sidecar to the Great Wall.
It is because the Great Wall is in the mountains. And then the most people go to the Great Wall using the car or... Most of people go using a bus. And then to bus or cars, they all go by the motorways and go to the two or three main points.
Yeah, yeah.
What we do is we do directly to the mountains, narrow roads, countryside, and really when you really have like an open deck visibility. So you really have like a great landscape and you can see everything. You can see people still traveling with their horse. You can see some sheep. You can see... You're in the countryside, really. And very close to Beijing, at only 50 kilometers from there, there's a totally different China. China, which is still rural, unfortunately, still poor, but it's also a very nice China.
And you become a curiosity for them.
Yeah, sure, yeah. That's what I'm seeing people say. When we are in Beijing, people who are used to take pictures of the locals, they get taken in picture.
Okay, I have to ask the obvious question. Do I get to wear goggles?
You can. We provide helmets, actually.
I want the leather helmet. I want the scarf. I want the goggles.
We have that. You have that. but like now it's winter, we provide helmets for the cold, but also for security reasons, you get some helmets sure. And then you have a visa and everything.
I love it. I think it's great. And how much does it cost?
It starts at 900 RMB, which is about $150 for the 2-hour tour.
You know what? 2 hours for that? Totally reasonable. Hey, Gail, I really appreciate that. But remember, if I'm coming back, I'm doing the trip. I want the goggles. I want the leather helmet. I want the scarf. And, of course, the one thing we all have to have, the photo of me in that sidecar. Nobody else will believe.
I promise. And you also get to get a video if you want.
Oh, God. Now you're pushing it. All right, Gail Thoreau. The owner of Beijing Sideways, a really great way to see a city in a completely different perspective. We'll be back with more Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the Opposite House in Beijing right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg coming to you from the Opposite House in Beijing, China, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. You know, earlier in the show, we were talking about the total, almost exponential expansion of everything that's happened in China over the last 20 years, not the least of which has been the choice of cuisine. And when I first came here, everybody went to one of six Peking duck restaurants. And there was one near the hospital. It was actually called the Sick Duck. Don't ask why, but that's what they called it. And I have to tell you, I've had better Peking duck in New York. Things have changed. Now it's cutting-edge cuisine here. It's five-star. It's a gastronomic experience. And earlier in the show, we were talking about the fact that Pizza Hut is considered a kind of an upscale restaurant here. Well, you know what? For my money, I'd much rather take the Quattro Formaggi pizza that's served right here at the opposite house at a restaurant called Sereno. And the chef of that restaurant is here with us now, and that's Marino D'Antonio. Did I get that right?
Yes,
perfect. A typical Chinese name.
Traditional Chinese, yes.
Okay, well, now I know a little bit about you because we've talked prior to coming on the air. You went from being a chef on Silver Sea Cruises.
Yes.
To being landlocked in Beijing running that restaurant. How did that happen?
It happened 6 years ago, and it was a decision that they make not quite easily because when they told me I have to come to Beijing, I was... not really happy about that because, you know, about the pollution or all these kind of things you heard about China never being here before.
Well, you do have a strange green glow to you. No, I'm kidding. No. 20 years ago when I was coming here, the idea of a cutting-edge restaurant, whether it's Italian cuisine, French cuisine, sushi, whatever, was unheard of because you couldn't source half the products and most of the people couldn't afford half the products. What's changed?
It changed that slowly. The product is getting available every year. You can find more and more product from Italy, from France, from everywhere around the world. So it's easy to get.
So if you want to get the mozzarella, you get the mozzarella.
Yes,
whatever you want, you get now, right? Is there something there's no way you can get it that you love?
Not really whatever, but most of the things you can get. And I have a lot of Italian friends who come and go from Beijing now, and sometimes we smuggle something from...
Really?
Yes.
Like what? Okay, just help me out. What are you smuggling?
Salami, guanciale, and parma ham because it's illegal
right to
get it here.
So basically you're wrapping it up in somebody's dirty laundry so nobody else smells it and you sneak it through. I know what you're doing. Right? It's
not really like that, yeah.
Well, listen, the old days in Spain, you couldn't bring back the Serrano ham, you know. And I would, they would shrink wrap it and flash freeze it, and I'd put it in with all the dirty laundry and hope the dogs wouldn't find it, because that was really now you can get it.
Yes, right. Now you can get it.
But is there something you can't get?
There are still a few meat products that you cannot get.
Oh, the smuggled salami.
The meat from the U.S. you cannot get, and that's really a pity because it's so good.
Where do you get your meat from then?
From Australia.
Ah, but they won't let the meat come in? Is there like an agricultural ban on it because of trade balance?
I have no idea about.
Okay, but the bottom line is you can't get it. But you get the Wagyu beef from
Australia.
Yes, that's good.
That's really good.
That's not bad. What about locally sourcing? What about the quality of the products in
locally
China?
Locally sourcing is getting better and better because more and more farms around the city, about 1.5 hour driving where it's more green and clean the air, you can get some biological farm. They raise your vegetable and your herbs, and so it's good to have some fresh herb every day. It's much more easy than before. Also, we have a producer who give us biological raised chicken and pork.
So. Well, now that never would have been the scene in China 10 years ago.
Impossible to think, yes.
Oh, my God. So now you actually have organically raised...
Chicken.
Pig too?
Yes.
Wow. Now, you have an item on the menu. It's a pig dish. What is it?
Yes, it's a baby pig.
It's a baby pig. It's a whole pig.
No, it's the leg.
The leg. The
baby pig leg.
But what I find interesting about the stuff is you roast it for like a day. I mean,
18 hours, yeah, slow cook.
Okay, I was off by 6 hours. Fine. But that's 18 hours.
Yes.
Slow roast.
Slow, 80 degree, yes.
Wow. That keeps
and
all
then the I finish it in the oven at 200 degree for...
To get it crispy on the outside.
To get it crispy outside.
See, even I got that concept. That's good. Now, is there one thing on the menu here? Because, you know, people have different palates. Is there one thing on the menu that you put on the menu you thought everybody's going to love and they didn't like it at all? And is there one thing that you thought no one's going to eat this and they can't get enough of it?
Yeah, there are a couple of items that for sure
like
you think they're like,
what?
Like the bacalao. I thought it was like selling out of
Washington. Explain bacalao.
Bacalao is a salt called fish from Portugal because
right.
Sereno is a Mediterranean restaurant.
Yes.
That is, you wash it in the water for 48 hours and then you cook it slowly with the potato and
nobody cared.
You make croquette.
Forget it.
And
done.
Nobody liked it because they say it's salty. They have this.
Well,
story.
That's what they call the salty.
Yeah, <Okay. but laughs>
I gotcha. But then you have stuff on the menu like the pig that goes big time.
Yeah, the pig is.
Marino D'Antonio from Silver Sea Cruises to your own ship right here at the opposite house in Beijing. Thank you very much for joining us. We
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate that. That music means you're out of time for the whole show. We got to say Sheshan. That means thank you to Mike Worrell, who drew the short straw once again and is stuck doing the engineering here. And our chief producer, Shelley Goncharowski, who's going to be leaving on a sidecar momentarily. Sweetie Nelson, Holly Brown, Elaine Yu, and all the staff at the Opposite House in Beijing. We'll see you next week from a different remote location somewhere in the world. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com.